I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. David Bernard joins me now in person, in studio, if you will. He's just published a new book, All the Way Home, Building Recovery That Works. It's a terribly engaging, cogent, and thought-provoking memoir about his years running a counseling program that helped hundreds of people with addictions to drugs and alcohol. The program began in 1967, and it went on for a few years. It's a fascinating program because it didn't involve harm reduction or any of the current modes of dealing with addiction. In the book, Mr. Bernard recounts what they did at Ex-Calais, this therapeutic community. At one point, they were running several businesses in Vancouver, a gas station, beauty parlor, restaurant, and a hotel. It was engaging the whole person that worked, getting the addicts to participate in the running of those businesses and having tasks at home to fulfill. In the early days of the 1970s, they expand with a facility in Winnipeg. A couple of years ago, David Bernard was on this program and recounted a recent visit he made there, seeing how it all flourished after all these years, turning out clean, sober citizens. This is a really great book in that it has some policy prescriptions as to what could happen today with the drug problems in the cities across the continent. It's also a great cultural history, an insightful look at therapy, and a great insight into David Bernard's own life, well, a small portion of it. It's, as the writer Tom Sanborn said in a recent Vancouver Sun review of the book, you are easily addicted to his splendid writing. I read it wanting more on his illustrious and colorful life since. For David Bernard has become well-known in this part of the world and elsewhere as a broadcaster, actor, and writer. He hosts a self-titled program on Shaw Community Television, Channel 4, and he blogs regularly. He's still in the addictions business. He runs therapy groups at Orchard Recovery Center on Bowen Island and is the executive director of the Drug Prevention Network of Canada. DavidBurner.com is the website for more, and where you can buy this book, Amazon.com also has it. Please welcome back to the Plant Online program, David Bernard. Mr. Bernard, good morning.
Lovely to see you. And also Amazon.ca and Amazon UK and Germany, Brazil, Australia.
That's great that people can get this book because, as I said in the introduction, it's a book that people ought to read. Whether or not they agree or disagree with the method that you've articulated here in terms of dealing with addictions, but just for the engaging nature of, I mean, that's you. You're in this book. I mean, that's you telling us these stories. Was it fun to write? I know it was a struggle to write.
It was fun to write. The first time I tried it, I rented a flat in Victoria for 2 weeks, left my home in Vancouver, and settled into a very disciplined 2 weeks of writing minimum 3 hours a day. And my focus was to get the story told. Don't worry about the writing. Don't worry about getting every detail. And in 2 weeks, I wrote 130 pages.
And having known you and talked about this off tape, if you will, about the struggle to get it all done, beyond that, in telling this story, it must be a great sort of valedictory in terms of the work that you did 45 years ago or so.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I'm incredibly proud of what we accomplished. I feel that it happened partly because of hard work, but largely because of luck. Yeah. We were just in the right place at the right time, and the gods just tapped us on the shoulder. But, you know, the man to whom the book is dedicated, my friend Jeff Q, I tell him often, I say, you know, Jeff, we did something.
Mm-hmm.
Not a lot of people can say that. We actually did something. We created an institution that's still running, still has 136 men, women, and children who still are people feeling safe when they've spent their lives not feeling safe and getting clean and sober and living decent lives. And I'm very proud of it. There's not much one can look back on in life. Of course, one has children, one does a job, and one does various things. But this is something substantial and substantive. There it is.
Yeah, and people can pick up the book to see what you all did. So you mentioned Jeff. He was part of this group called Council
Company of Young Canadians.
Company of Young Canadians, and it's sort of like a Peace Corps type deal that we had in this country in the mid-60s. Yeah. You've told us about that and how it came about, but I guess let's begin with where you were in 67, 1967. You're what, 23, 24 years old?
In 66, I met him, and I was 23 years old. I was living in Vancouver, driving a taxi, and being a yellow cab dispatcher, and drinking a lot of wine, and smoking a lot of pot, and having a lot of fun. And you know, Joseph, you know, if you're lucky when you're 23, you are having a lot of fun, but at the same time, I was miserable. I was unfocused, and I didn't sleep that well, or at least I didn't get to sleep until 4 in the morning, and didn't get up till noon, and, you know, and my life was really two different things. On the one hand, I was driving a taxi, and it was all about cash, you know, give me some money. And the rest of my life was all about the arts. All of my friends were poets and photographers and painters, you know, and musicians, and I hung out with artistic people, and I was sort of learning the saxophone, and I was writing a novel, writing poetry, and, you know, I was a sort of a mad beatnik before there were hippies and so on. And I was unhappy. I needed to go and get myself into something.
How did you know that it was addictions and or therapy or helping people as you did?
I didn't know. I honest to God, I had no idea.
So you never set out to that this was what I was going to do?
No. I'm in that regard, I'm very lucky. There are three things that I did intend to do, and I did them. When I was a little boy, I wanted to sing and dance on stages in front of people, and I ended up doing that. I've done a ton of musical comedy and acting. Then when I was about 10 or 11, I visited CBC Studios, and I thought to myself, oh, I could do this, and I ended up spending half my life in studios. So there were a number of things I wanted to do that I've done, but in this regard, I didn't know that this was for me until I'd been involved in it for about 4 months. I simply knew that what I was doing was a waste of time. And somebody pointed me in the direction of this office and this guy, and the guy and I hit it off. You know, it's the old story, Joe. Personal relationships are everything. So I just liked this guy, and I liked what he was talking about. And he said, here's four projects. Take them home and read about them and see if you could contribute. And I came back the next day, and I said, well, these three are nonsense. They're just people talking about nothing. But this one is interesting. And this one was guys in the penitentiary saying, we got to get out and stay out.
And then I guess the focus was, in the beginning, that it was Native men who were in jail. And this was sort of the halfway house to transition back into whatever regular society, if you will.
Exactly. But what happened was that we didn't have any shape or any form. And oddly enough, the thing that set us off in the right direction was watching television in the afternoon one day. We saw this documentary about a place called Daytop Center in Staten Island, New York. And Daytop was a spin-off of the granddaddy of all the recovery centers, all the residential treatment centers in the therapeutic model, therapeutic community model. That was a thing called Synanon, which doesn't exist anymore. And we watched this movie, and we went, oh, my God, that's what we should be doing. And it was people confronting each other and being honest with each other and saying, look, buddy, you can't do that, and who are you trying to kid, and so on. And so, you know, through connections, I met a famous psychologist, and he started us off in that direction, and we started doing groups. We started doing group work, and before we knew it, the thing just took off.
Some of the group work, and there is a transcript of one of these sessions. What do you call it? The game?
The game,
I mean, it's quite intense.
Yes.
It's like a play almost, reading it in the book. That's one of the so-called pillars, if you will, in terms of your pillars, in terms of how to deal with addictions problems. Yeah. It's that. It's having the responsibility. You get up in the morning. I mean, you're provided room and board, essentially, living in the facility, which in your case were these houses that you all bought in the city.
Yeah.
You had to get up, make your bed, and then you all had jobs, whether you cleaned, whether you prepared breakfast.
Yeah.
It makes sense. I mean, it's common sense that this is what one needs in terms of recovery and recovering. Why does it seem odd in today's context, maybe. I mean,
well, there are lots of recovery houses who do exactly the same thing, and they do really good work. I mean, there's lots of them. There's a few right within walking distance of where we're now sitting,
yeah,
that have been in business for 30 years doing exactly the same kind of thing, doing marvelous work. But the overweening public policy these days is to try to find a magic pill, a magic solution, which is exactly what addicts do.
Mm-hmm.
And so our public policy is actually imitating addicts. Addicts don't want a mortgage, and they don't want insurance, mm-hmm, and they don't want children. They want drugs or alcohol, mm-hmm, to solve everything. So the powers that be are looking for the silver bullet. And so they want, let's give everybody methadone. Let's, mm-hmm, give everybody free alcohol. Let's give everybody clean crack pipe kits. Let's give everybody needles. Let's give people a place to shoot up. I just don't have it in me to walk up to an addict and say, I'd like to help you shoot up, because I think shooting up is a lunatic activity. So if I meet an addict, I say, hey, Jack, how'd you like to escape this nutty life?
Mm-hmm.
You know, let's move on. And if Jack says, yeah, let's go try, I say, we're not going to try. We're going to do it, buddy. And we do it. Would you, look, let me put it this way, Joe. I've worked with hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of prostitutes, mostly female, mm-hmm, some male, mostly female. I've never met a prostitute who wants to stay in the life.
Mm-hmm.
So the current rage is to make prostitution safe.
Yeah.
Quotation marks around safe, because of course we don't want people killed. We don't want more
disease.
Pictons. Yeah. You know, we don't want more guys murdering prostitutes after they party with them. So,
mm-hmm,
of course, naturally, we all agree with that. But on the other hand, I don't want to make prostitution safe. I want prostitutes to. I don't want them hurt, but I want them to remember that this is an absolutely foul, miserable business. They're basically just renting out body parts by the half hour.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not a dignified activity. And all human beings have to have dignity. You know, it's a terrible thing that as you and I, as we speak, we're in comfort, we're safe, we have a warm, well-lit place. Half the world doesn't. Half the world has mortar shells, doesn't have food, and so on. But once you can establish the basics of food and shelter, you hope that human beings have dignity. What the heck are all... What are religions about? Religions, mm-hmm, about not just the spiritual life, but about how we live here on earth in a spiritual way. And that includes self-respect. You can't have self-respect when you're turning tricks in the back of a Chevy.
Well, what makes the addict different than, say, the average person, if you will? There are people that can have a drink or two regularly and not spiral down into addiction. Have you figured out in all of your years of therapy and counseling, I mean, are people wired, are some people wired differently?
Yes, they are. And I'm not a scientist, so I can't tell you that they're born this way or that they're imprinted this way. My own sense of it is that whether or not people may have a genetic disposition to alcoholism or addiction, they certainly have imprinting, and by the time they're five, the game is on.
Mm-hmm.
It's a social environment kind of thing. And here's the difference. The difference is the maturation process. This is the normal maturation process. We go from dependency to independence to interdependence. We go from, we must suck on our mother's breast, dad has to bring home the bacon, whatever model you want. People have to provide food and shelter, make sure we don't get hit by cars, and so on. And when a child is 2 years old, the child begins that process of individuation. No, no,
yeah,
no. Okay, and then when you're in your teen years, then it's really no. Don't tell me what to do. I know how to, you know, blah, blah, blah. If they're lucky, they survive that and get into their 20s and live as independent people. If you're really lucky, as you get older, you learn how to operate interdependently so that you and I are colleagues and friends. We're not hung up on each other. We respect each other. We say hi. We do work together. And then we part company. We don't, you know, we're not sweating, oh, I didn't see Joe for 3 hours. You know, I'm not dependent on you.
Right.
What happens with addicts, Joseph, is that addicts go from dependency, When they get to the so-called independent stage, it's a sham. They, in fact, go from dependency on parents to new dependencies. The dependencies are on alcohol and drugs and on other people. You'll see invariably that alcoholics and addicts have terrible interpersonal relationships, codependent relationships. One of the standard syndromes is women who hook up with abusive men. I see this week after week after week with clients. Mm-hmm. So what we have to do, that's how they're different. They don't get to the independent stage in a clear, direct, simple, useful way. They get into a sort of fake independent stage. And what we have to do is stop and redo the whole growing up process. Addicts are essentially locked somewhere between the age of 5 and 14.
And so that's what you did at Ex-Kelly. I mean, if you wanted to be part of the community to get off drugs and alcohol,
yep,
or any other addictions that one might have, you did have to act independently within this community. And you had to do it. I remember in the book you talk about Jeff Massey offers you the Carnegie Center on Main and Hastings. Yeah. And I mean, it's a great building, of course, yeah, and you could have easily turned that into a center, yeah, but it wasn't the right area. You were also offered a farm at one point, but, you know, that's out.
We were also offered all of Ocean Falls.
Really?
We were offered the entire community of Ocean Falls. And in all of those instances, Joe, and I'm glad you remember those details, we said no, because you can't, in my opinion, you can't do any serious rehab work at the corner of Main and Hastings. Yeah. You can't, what's the payoff? Yeah. Why would I want to get clean and sober and still be surrounded by garbage? Okay? All our programs were usually in cities or just in the suburbs on the outskirts of cities, mm-hmm, because we want all the toys that cities offer. We want museums. We want gymnasia. We want swimming pools. We want playing fields. We want the opportunity to go to the Queen Elizabeth Theater and see Ray Charles or whoever the current rage is. We want to be able to see musical comedy. We want to see rock stars. We want public libraries. We want all of those facilities, but we don't want to be surrounded by our former life. We don't want to be surrounded by drug dealers. Of course, every child today is now surrounded by drug dealers.
Yeah. And so you buy these houses. I mean, that was the key, that you had to own the facility. You had to own the bricks and mortar. You had to own the building. You bought a house in Fairview, ended up a house in Shaughnessy. These businesses that you had, pens and pizzas and
all
restaurants.
Yeah, yeah.
It was rewarding work. You saved a lot of people. But after a while, you got burned out yourself, right?
Absolutely.
And so there was no plan to succeed you.
No, that was my fault. That was a failure on my part.
And so how did it last? What, 10 years or so?
It lasted here 10 years. And also, we were the non-flavor of the day in our 10th year. In other words, the provincial government really was starting to hate us. They didn't like us at all, even though their own people wrote rave reviews about our work. They just didn't believe in what we were doing. So fortunately, we closed here, unfortunately, but fortunately in 71, in our fifth year, we opened in Winnipeg, and the Winnipeg thing took off and went from, I sent five recovering addict alcoholics from Vancouver, and they opened the Winnipeg facility. Within 2 weeks, there were 15 people, and pretty soon there were 30 or 40, and then we got this unbelievable property near the university, and soon there were 100, and now there's 136 in two locations.
Yeah, and so you were there a couple years ago, is that right?
Yes, I've been there several times in the last few years, yes.
It must be gratifying, it must be fun to go back there and see what you started 42 years ago, so?
Yeah, it's not only gratifying and fun, it's emotionally powerful. I'm usually in tears when I'm there, because I as egocentric as I am, I'm, you know, an absolutely ordinary person, and so, you know, I think to myself, my God, I dropped a pebble in a pond, and these ripples have been gone, and here's some people who are profiting from what we did, 40 years later, and they weren't even born when we did what we did. You know, but the problems aren't going away. There are always going to be people like this, you know. So it's tremendously gratifying. I feel like for all the frivolous things I've done in my life that are just silly fun, this is something real and substantial. And yeah, so I think it's wonderful.
Why can't this be done today? I mean, is it red tape? Is it regulation?
Yeah, it can be done today, but let me give you an example. There's a wonderful man who was the mayor of Maple Ridge. His name is Gordy Robson. He currently writes for the Maple Ridge Times. He's a self-made millionaire. And Gord Robson, when he was running for office some years ago, he said, if I'm elected mayor, I will open a youth treatment facility with my own money. And he bought a house, and he hired a psychologist, and he was ready to rock and roll. And the moment he was mayor, he opened the doors, and he was ready to take in, I think, half a dozen youngsters who had addictions problems. He never got to take in one client because either it was the Maple Ridge authorities or the provincial authorities. Somebody came in and said, well, you don't have push doors on the doors, and you don't have hallways wide enough, because it's not an institution, it's an actual house, you know, like where people live.
Yeah.
So it's that kind of madness that's going on. It would be very hard to do today because we have so many levels of government and so many mandarins and bureaucrats who are all covering their butt and all checking up on everything. For example, when you have a child, I'm talking about teenagers, when you have a child out of control, William Glasser, who wrote the legendary groundbreaking book Reality Therapy 40 years ago, with whom I had the privilege of working, Glasser said, when someone's out of control, the first thing you have to do is stop them. Just stop, then we can do the work. Well, if you have a 16-year-old boy or girl who's out of control, and they're in your program, and they start freaking out, you have to say, excuse me, Betty, just stop. Just sit still for a minute, you know. Well, the authorities today wouldn't let you say that. They'd say, why are you harassing this child? You know, well, because the child is acting like a lunatic, so we have to just get the kid calmed down for openers, you know.
Well, what do you want people to get out of this book?
I want people to say, look, recovery for all human beings is possible. And recovery involves really two things. I mean, in this work that we did and in the work that other people do like this today, we do two things. We love people and we kick their butt simultaneously and every day. Half the time we're going, hey, Bob, thanks so much. We're putting our arm around someone and saying, that's great. That was a terrific piece of work. We really appreciate it. Okay. I'm told regularly in my work with clients that I create an atmosphere of safety and buoyancy and they feel comfortable. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the things you have to do. You have to let people feel safe. And the other thing you do is we kick their butt. We say, what are you doing? You can't do that. Yeah. That's dopey. Okay. This happened just a few days ago. Just a few days ago, I found out that a guy had tried to kill himself that day. And I was shocked, and I was actually in tears. I just put my hand on his shoulder, and I said, buddy, don't do that. I know this sounds frivolous. It sounds like it doesn't mean anything, but it does mean something. I put my hand on his shoulder. I said, I don't want to hear this. Don't do this. You break my heart if you hurt yourself. I don't want you. Now, this is not what people are taught to do in psychology school, but that's what you do. So I want people, what do I want people to get out of the book? That there is hope, there is optimism, that people are not broken. The addicts and alcoholics are not broken toys. They're people with a problem. They're people with an issue, with several issues. And you can work your way out of it. Can someone please explain to these mandarins who want to give, you know, substitute drugs to everybody? Can they explain the success of Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, Cocaine Anonymous, Overeaters Anonymous, Emotions Anonymous? Millions and millions of people worldwide walk into church basements and say, hi, my name is Bob, I'm an alcoholic, and they get clean and sober. I have many friends who've been clean and sober between 20 and 50 years. By going to a meeting once a week.
Yeah.
You know, it's beautiful. It's a beautiful thing. Yeah. You don't have to. I think it's ugly and mean and short-sighted to give people the means to stay stupid.
But that's the I guess, the fashion nowadays. That's the sort of where the politicians are. Do you see any way that we'll get away from this?
Yes, I think. Well, I think a swing is on. I'm a little optimistic. I'm seeing some very good work being done, and I just saw here in this province several backbenchers who have the same thought process that I do, mm-hmm. and have gone and investigated things, and they've gone to the ministry and they've said, "Look," and they've gone to the whole caucus, in fact, and said, "Look. Wake up, folks. This is what's going on. We need more resources, more money put into treatment. Treatment's cheap. Treatment beds are cheap. And it works. Does it work for everybody all the time, first time round? No. But ultimately, it works for many, many, many people, you know? Yeah. So why would we give up on them and say, we want you on methadone maintenance? And by the way, the skullduggery that goes on in things like methadone maintenance is appalling. There's a guy who runs 10 so-called recovery homes in one of our suburbs. Every one of those homes is filled with clients on methadone maintenance. They're taking methadone all the time. Guess who the guy is? He's a pharmacist. Mm. Follow the money. Yeah. First principle of journalism.
Yeah. Sanborn says in his review of the book that you're easily addicted to your writing. You tell a good story. I mean, that's one of your gifts. People that have known you through radio, like I did, notice that. I mean, that's what we liked about you and your show. Will you write again? And I mean, I was just thinking of your mom. There's a great line in the book about, she used to tell you this all the time, if I am not for me, who will be? If for me alone, what am I? If not now, when?
What a dirty trick. To mention my mother and that quote. Yeah, look, I have a friend who's a rabbi, and he told me years ago I should write a book of daily meditations. And I said, what are you talking about? He said, well, you're a great storyteller, and you're also a great philosopher and moralist. Yeah. So I'm actually thinking of writing one of these 365-page books.
Yeah.
With a story on each page and the moral of the story at the bottom. The stories would be real stories for real life, because I got a million of them, as you know.
Yeah,
I think I'll write again. I'm just in the heady phase of marketing this book, mm-hmm. and it's exciting and fun and exhausting. But, yeah, I'll write again. And also, I tell you honestly, because I've been a writer for years, just the last few days I've had this title in my head, Stories Yellow and Green, and I'm thinking of a book of short stories. Mm. You know, I don't have a novel in my head, and secretly, you know what I wish I could do?
What's that?
Write a really good detective or spy novel or crazy person novel.
Actually, speaking of spy novels,
yes.
Philip K. Dick.
Yes,
he was a client, wasn't he?
He was.
S. Kelly.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. You don't remember him. Seeing him there, did you or do you?
I saw him, but I don't remember a thing about him.
Yeah,
he came to us in the early 70s at this mansion in Shaughnessy, and Philip K. Dick, if there's somebody listening to this who has no idea who he is, every year a science fiction writing award is given, and his short stories have been turned into the most profitable
Terminator
movies.
And
or Total Recall and Tom Cruise. I mean, everybody's been in a movie based on a Philip K. Dick story. Anyways, so he came in and he said that he was addicted to pills and alcohol, and he was a writer, and we never cared who anybody was. We could have had the prime minister and we would have cared less, you know. All we saw was someone who had an alcohol and an addiction problem. So we said, well, that's nice. Being a writer has gotten you a top bunk at the Excalibur Foundation. And he stayed for only 3 weeks and then went away. And I never really took note of the guy and didn't notice that he was Philip K. Dick, you know. Only years later realized, eventually I interviewed his widow on my first radio show. She and he lived in Big Sur, California, and she told me that he had been clean and sober ever since he'd been to this program, and then I read this bio of him in the 90s, which has 3 pages about ex-Calais, about how he went there, and while he thought it was a kind of Protestant work ethic, old-fashioned, corny kind of place, he never used again. And so we thought that was a great coup.
Yeah. See, I've known you, about 4 or 5 years, but I feel like I've known you, I'd say, 20. listening to you, actually, which is really odd, because in this house, listening to you in the old NW show. So it's kind of neat, actually, if you'll allow me a minute here.
It is 20, because I started there in 93.
To have you come over and do my show now. I mean, it's peculiar, but it's fun.
No, it's great.
So I've only known you, say, 20 years, and so, you know, in those years, the showbiz years, if you will, the radio shows, the acting on the stage, Shylock. You've told us stories of your years at Ex-Calais, the recovery and addictions counseling, but you've had this remarkable life since then, and counseling is still there. If you're remembered for anything, you'll probably be remembered for Ex-Calais and your work in this that you recount in this book. I mean, that's a pretty good legacy, isn't it?
It's a wonderful legacy.
Yeah.
Yeah. The other stuff has been, Joe, I've had a lot of fun. I've interviewed or acted with or played with some of the most famous people in contemporary life. I have a list of Oscar winners that I've interviewed, Emmy winners, Grammy winners, athletes who have been on the world stage, writers, politicians, murderers, all kinds of entrepreneurs, zillionaires, and so on. All of that's been wonderful fun, and not just fun. I mean, I've learned so much. If you spend 3 hours alone in a hotel room with B.B. King, you got to learn something, right? Yeah. So all of that's great, and it's a blessing, but I would say that nothing really compares to, I mean, this is the punchline.
Yeah, and it's still rewarding work for you. I know you do work on Bowen Island, and
it's incredibly rewarding. It's demanding because it's emotionally involving, but it's wonderful because I'll just give you one example. I went to an orchard annual reunion thing. I forget what they call it, but anyways, so you have former clients showing up, and the first two people who came running up to me were these two young women, both of whom were now clean and sober a year. One of them, I expected her to be clean and sober, frankly. Mm-hmm. I expected her to do well. The other one, I wouldn't have bet you a plug nickel that she would have lasted 3 days. And here she is a year clean and sober. And you know that you had some small part in that. Always it's people's choice. I mean, I have no control over your life. Mm-hmm. It's your choice what you do, right? To know that you had some little push in that is a beautiful thing.
I hope people pick up this book because it is just a terribly engaging story. It's fun. It's sad. I mean, there's some frightening moments at times. I mean, there's some close calls in those houses that you stayed at. But it's for all your gifts as a storyteller, as a bon vivant, and as a raconteur, I mean, it's all there. Congratulations on this book, and it's good to see you again. Thanks for coming in to do this.
Thank you, Joe.
DavidBurner.com is the website for more. The book is called All the Way Home, Building a Recovery That Works. You can buy it on Amazon.com, Amazon.ca, also on David's website, DavidBurner.com. The author, David Burner, joined me in studio here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plata.